Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 149, being recorded on the 19th of October, 2016. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale and Evan. So it's the old gang back together again. We don't have any special guests today, but we've got an interesting topic to talk about, which we just somehow have not talked about it before, and that's the topic of IoT Hub. A very interesting topic. I'm sure a lot of listeners are, already know about this, but we'll kind of give everybody a little bit of the lay of the land as to what it is and what it's good for. But before we get there, as usual, let's just do a quick roundup of the updates. And there were a few. Evan, thanks for putting in Kale as well. You want to start with something there?
Yeah, I just kind of all up, really talk about the ExpressRoute stuff. You know, as you guys know, ExpressRoute's near and dear to me, although I don't spend as much time with it as I used to. But we've, I guess this happens sometimes, but very rarely do people increase their SLA, right? So we've changed our SLA from 99.9 to 99.95. Now, this does require discontinuation of a lower SKU and like, but we also, we're just trying to make this more highly available across the board, right? And that requires some architectural changes, but the nice thing is that allows us to really, bump our SLA, which is a great thing for our customers.
Cool. There's quite a few updates there, I noticed, so I think that's good. What about the other one with the basic gateway? Is this being discontinued now?
Yeah, that's relative to that. That's kind of related to the SLA, right? The basic gateway, just the way it works, we can't get the uptimes that we want, right? So in order to drive the SLA up, we had to, just basically get rid of that SKU. The other two in there, we're just increasing our documentation, like we always are trying to, or improving it. And then this one, if you do public peering, right, you're supposed to, for your subnets that you advertise to us, for the peering IPs, you're supposed to do public IPs. We used to allow private, and then we said, hey, we're switching to public. We were trying to enforce it. We kind of slacked off on enforcing it, and I think now we're kind of going back to, we're going to enforce it, we got to get it going, and customers should move to that or make plans to move to a public range in the near future if possible, if at all possible.
And what's the kind of advantage or disadvantage of using the public range there?
It's really, from a technical perspective, it's transparent. If what it really sets you up for is over time, I think you're going to see Microsoft peering and Azure public peering move closer together. And Microsoft peering today, because we actually inject customers' routes directly into our corporate network, have to be public IPs, right? That somebody actually owns. And so I think this is, really about bringing those two in line in terms of their functionality. So when we are able to merge those, there's no requirement for customers who come on board with this configuration to make any changes to their side to do that.
Right.
So it's kind of setting up the future there.
Okay. Very good. Thanks. Then, Kale, I'm sure you want to dive into the blockchain update?
No, he doesn't want to talk about blockchain.
No doubt. Hot off the press today. New blog post up there about the blockchain infrastructure updates. So the templates we put out there originally, or that the product group actually put out there, has been tweaked slightly to include some updates. And you can take a look at what they are. You can make smaller networks now. They found a way to do that, as well as make it resilient to reboots. There's some diagnostics pieces and a couple other optimizations in the actual ARM templates that makes things a little bit faster. So if you're using that, or if you're involved in blockchain work, take a look at it. It's free. It's available on the GitHub, and you can take a look at it. The other one, there's a couple other ones that were close here. The other one was the DocDB. Do a lot of work with that, and there's a new metrics blade and some collections management changes. So if you take a look at that, there's basically new There's like different metrics that show up there in like graph form, you know, in the portal for you to see about your collections and your databases and all the different things that are happening with your DocDB. So if you are using DocDB, definitely something to take a look at. And then there's a bunch of other stuff around that, not just like nice GUI stuff up there. There's a lot of cool stuff around the collections management, like I mentioned before. So take a look at that. Things have been changed. I think these were driven a lot from the user voice stuff. So direct feedback. So it's pretty cool.
Nice. And then just a reminder to all our listeners that the managed cache and in-role cache service, which you know, has been marked for deprecation quite a while ago, is going to shut down on the 30th of November 2016. And so by then, you should be moved on to the Azure Redis cache service, which is our service going forward. Yep.
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, I don't have the experience with caching, but do you guys know what's the migration story from the kind of the custom one we wrote to Redis? Is it a reasonably small change, or is this how difficult is this for customers to do?
I worked on that with somebody a while back on a caching. It wasn't that exact migration. It wasn't going from like in-role to Redis. It was going from a third party to Redis. And I think it really depends on how much abstraction, at least in the case what I worked on, how much abstraction they put in their app. So, like, you could have, like, a cache manager, for lack of a better term, that plugs a provider in, like Redis or InRule.
Right.
And then it implements it. So your code necessarily wouldn't need to change so much as plugging that new provider in. Now, the reality is that's 100%.
Not everybody does that either, yeah. Go ahead.
And there's so many new features also that are available. I think, you know, to take advantage of everything that Redis cache, you probably want to step back and take a look at your caching architecture and take advantage of all the features. But, yeah, in terms of getting it quickly migrated, I think what Cale says is if you're using the provider model, you're in good shape. Otherwise, you've got to make a few changes. It's not major.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because, you know, I got to say as a support person, I actually really applaud this engineering team for at some point choosing to actually shut these off, right?
Yeah.
Because this is kind of the challenge. I think our industry as a whole has this, right? I mean, I guarantee I could go find some NT4 machines still today. Right?
Yeah, because you never take them offline. You just don't know.
You just hope there's this impression that if we don't touch a computer or don't touch a code base, it'll just somehow never go bad. But, you know, the data changes or use patterns change. And so I don't think it's a bad thing when there is something like this for kind of us to enforce a hard cutoff. Now, I'm sure there's some dev team or somebody who has a product that really heavily depends on this is probably screaming at me now. But trust me, people, in the end, you will be in a better place. It is worth the short-term pain, I think.
And to be clear, the not the managed cache, but the in-role cache service, that only works with cloud services, right? Like classic, not ARM?
Yeah. So any new code is... But I think that's the thing, right? New code probably hasn't been using that anyway.
Right.
Right. Even if they could, they wouldn't be. They'd be using Redis, I would think.
And Evan, you know, I was just thinking that I'm sure from a support perspective, they must be able to collect some sort of a report, right, indicating which customers are still using that service.
Yeah. So I'm not in support in that area anymore. But yeah, I know for like some of the other services I've used in the past, we have really good telemetry. This is actually one of the cool things about cloud services instead of on-premises products, right, is we have real live telemetry on who's using it. So I'm sure this decision is driven to some extent by the numbers hit some minimum. And you know what? I don't know for sure because, again, I'm not on that particular support team, but a lot of other products we have the ability to toast and email individual customers, say, hey, reminder, this is coming, you're using it.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah.
Just kind of make them on to move off, yeah.
Yeah.
If that count has got to reach zero by the end of November.
Yeah, I suspect there's a handful of people that are probably really upset, and I feel for them, I absolutely do. But yeah, I think we're, you know, it's not like, I don't think they're going to be able to say they didn't know.
Okay.
Right, I'm really just, hard to notify.
Yeah. And just quickly move on to another update, which is with the Azure Management Libraries. There is a Java version, which is still in beta, beta 3 now, just came out. And this allows people to use, maybe some code running on non-Windows platforms written in Java that need to do some sort of a management operation like provisioning machines in load balancers, etc. And they made a whole bunch of enhancements now where you can do parallel creation of machines, virtual machines, key vault, batch access, Azure Batch, etc. So they've added a whole bunch of new features in there to that Java SDK if that's what you're using.
And did you guys see there's also a .NET variant of that as well?
Yep.
That looks like it uses almost the exact same structure and approach. Actually,
it's nice to see them keeping them, keeping the Java one up to date.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So we're going to try and get them. We have a couple emails out to that team. We're going to try and get them on here for our audience. So.
Yeah. The last one, and it kind of has an evil plan too, is the Azure Security Center.
Evil plan?
From my side, my evil plan there is to get them on the podcast as well to talk about that. We'll give them a shout out here. There was a post about them, the top four reasons for using the ACS, the Azure Security Center, for partner security solutions. So if you take a look at that, it's pretty cool. And actually, like Evan said, been reaching out to those guys to see if they want to join and talk about that in detail in a future podcast.
Yep. Okay. So I think that's a wrap, right, for the updates. Anything else?
No, off the top of my head.
That's it.
Yeah. Kale, you want to touch on something?
No, nothing. Just okay. Blockchain.
Yep.
Blockchain.
So let's get on to IoT Hub, right? I think this is something that we probably talked about quite a bit just in passing in previous episodes, but never really got into. And, have you guys been playing around with a Raspberry Pi or anything like that? Have you guys done any work with IoT devices?
I have not. I mean, I'd love to. I did some stuff a long, 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 long time ago with some breadboards and stuff, but this is kind of the modern version, but no, I have not.
Yeah. I mean, Kayla, I think you said you have a RP2, right?
Yeah, I have a 2, like I mentioned to you. And I tinker with it from time to time. I don't have enough time in a day to play with these things all the time. But, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I got an RP3, and I've been playing around a little bit with it. And that's how I got interested into the event, into the IoT Hub. But it took a while for me to understand, what the value proposition for IoT Hub is, right? And that's what a lot of people ask me, is why do I need IoT Hub, right? And so actually that's a good way to, at least I found, to explain to people why they need IoT Hub is to imagine for a minute you never had IoT Hub, right? And you were to do this, but you have all these IoT devices, right? Like the RP, the Raspberry Pis, maybe you have, many of them and that you have to somehow collect information from these devices, and they kind of spread all over the place, all over the world, maybe. And this is, let's suppose you didn't have IoT Hub or that never existed. What would you do? You have to somehow enable those devices to communicate with your application. Let's say you build some sort of a web API in a very simple use case, and then each of these applications, these devices, you would write some code in them to call their web API, once every whatever, so many minutes or seconds, and deliver some payload of information, right, about the status of that device. So that's a very easy kind of way to do, and I can do that, right? Anybody can do that. But now you still have to take all that information, and you got to make sure that you can scale up to the number of devices. As IoT devices can increase dramatically because they're typically very small, and there's so many different kinds and many of them. Your service would have to be able to handle quite a bit of scale. So that's one thing to keep in mind, that just the scaling of the service can be a challenge sometimes if you're trying to enable it for IoT access. And then, a lot of people say, okay, let's use Service Bus. Azure has something called Service Bus, which is the queue in the cloud. And that's another way you could go. You don't have to build a web API. You can just say, okay, my devices, my IoT devices are just going to talk to Service Bus and drop a message in the queue. And then, we'll have an application reading that on the other side. which is fine. You can do that. But then you got to start worrying about, you know, what am I going to do with all this information, right? I'm collecting all this, these messages from these devices. What am I doing with them? Okay, so I have to build some infrastructure to process all this information. And yes, we could start leveraging some of the other Azure features, I suppose, you know, that do stream analytics and things like that. But you still have to build a pipeline to send all this information to stream analytics and send it up before the processing, or maybe just put it into blob storage and process it later. And then the most important thing with IoT, I think, which a lot of people take for granted, is security. You got to have security both for devices sending information as well as the ultimate thing, which is being able to send a command back to a device. Because really, in the end of the day, you've got these IoT devices spread all over the place, and well, you know, you want to control them, right? You don't have them everywhere just for the heck of them. Yes, they're sending you information, but at some point you also want to send information back to those devices, say, you know, turn off this light or turn on that sensor or, you know, what's the light reading, what's the temperature reading, et cetera. So you have to send commands to the devices as well as get information from them, and you want to do it in a way that's very, very secure. Obviously, you know, the last thing you want is someone trying to hack into the system and try to pump it with, you know, errand data that would cause you to do all sorts of weird things. So that's the whole security aspect of it. So, and then there's the provisioning aspect, right? How do you provision all these devices? Because to have security, you need to provision them. If you need to provision them, now you have to have this elaborate database. You can use DocumentDB, I suppose, and create this, you know, elaborate system where you have, you know, you create devices in a table and then have some administration and things on it. I guess the point I'm trying to make with all this is that, you know, what starts off as a very simple thing to do with IoT devices, when you add all the pieces together, there's a lot, right? There's just a lot of them, that a lot of little things that come up.
Isn't this is like the story that you always see, right? Sounds really easy, and then when you start layering in any sort of complexity, we're all writing the same scaffolding code over and over and over again.
Exactly. Yep. And that's that's a very good point, Evan, is that, okay, you know, you did solution A, now you do solution B, and you kind of have to do the same thing again.
Yeah.
And every company is doing the same thing. And I think, you know, doing all this stuff that I just talked about at scale, being able to do it, offering, you know, being in debugging, or have all those features where you can do diagnostics, things like that. It's difficult. It takes a lot of work. And so that's what I think what Microsoft decided to do is to take all these common use patterns and put them all together into a nice little package. And that's essentially what IoT Hub is, you know, just at a high level. That's how I like to explain to people. You know, this is what you could have written by yourself. Yes, you could have done it. You sat down for and a team of people for a few months. You probably can build this yourself. But this is what you get out of IoT Hub, a completely battle-tested system that does everything that I just explained, and it provides it in a nice little package. So let's kind of, you know, talk about some of the individual pieces. Kale, you want to add something there?
Yeah, just one thing, and it kind of drives home the point here, is if you look at Microsoft as a whole, especially like Azure, as I don't even know how many services are in there right now. If you said each one of these discrete services, like it's storage and compute, and even compute breaks down into sub-things. But, you know, all those pieces together can form great things, right? We can build applications that scale to, you know, relative infinity, basically, you know, and we can do these great things. But like you said, Siji, it requires a lot of effort. And when someone comes and says, okay, I just built the next thermostat, the next Nest, and I think it's really cool because it does this other advanced feature, but it obviously needs to be able to connect to the internet and do these advanced things that you're talking about, provisioning and bidirectional communication and be secure and all these kind of things. I think those people are not looking for, hey, we have all the pieces you need here, put them together. It's like a little puzzle. They're looking to say, where is this thing in a solution? You know, like, I need a solution. And in some cases, they're going to hire some consultant to go try to put these together, or they're going to try to put them together themselves. And I just think this kind of drives home the point of us building solutions as part of the cloud, that's kind of a unique offering where it's a hybrid, or I guess, I don't know what you call it, a mix of all the services we have in there put together, right, in a way that forms a solution. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's actually kind of the next step up to IoT Hub. You know, you could take IoT Hub and then combine it with other things. I think that's what you're referring to, right? The IoT solution suite, or IoT suite is what they call it, I think. So we have packaged offerings for specific use cases like telemetry collection or vehicle management, things like that, you know. So they've got these packaged solutions that do a lot of that stuff out of the box. But let's kind of delve into a few things that we just talked about and see how IoT Hub handles some of the challenges we just talked about. Let's start with the very basic thing, you know, getting the data from the IoT device into this so-called thing, hub, you know, the thing that we call the hub. And the hub, you can think of it as some sort of a gateway. I like to think of it as a gateway, right? Because on one side of the gateway, let's say the left side of the gateway, you have the devices that are connected to it. And on the right side of the gateway, you've got your business logic or your applications that are interested in the information that these devices are putting out or want to send some interesting information back to these devices. So if you look at it from that perspective, the IoT Hub sits in the middle, and it's offering this gateway between the IoT population of devices and your application logic. Okay, and this thing sits in the middle. So if you keep that in mind, the first step would be just to send information into this IoT Hub or this gateway. And I talked about using, you know, you could use just a web API, a very simple way to do it if you did it yourself, or you could use Service Bus. The problem with those approaches is that a lot of IoT devices don't support making HTTP calls. You know, they would only, for example, work with AMQP, which is a fairly common queuing protocol, Advanced Message Queuing Protocol, I think is what it stands for. Which is more session-oriented versus Service Bus and Web APIs, which are more request-response type and not seen as being very efficient if you have to send a number of messages, at a very high clip. So AMQP is very popular in the IoT world, and of course, Service Bus doesn't support AMQP, unfortunately. So the IoT Hub does offer an AMQP endpoint that all the IoT devices can talk to and connect in and send information. Of course, they also do support just Web API style connectivity, so you can also use that as well.
I'm wondering, Sajid, and I don't know if you know this or not, is the like some of the common issues with these things. We think about, you know, at least in past days when I used to think about websites we were building where there was tens of thousands of users, we think about, well, you know, they're going to be on a decent internet connection, they're going to be like this or that, and that's what we have some assumptions going into how we can build the site and how quickly it's going to respond. But right. Like on these, I think that's like a big thing, right, with these devices, that they're not as reliable, like at least from a networking perspective. And is there any kind of tweaks, or does that protocol kind of help that AMQP with the, well, I have connected and then I disconnected and I'm not really a super reliable connection and I'll try again?
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. Yeah, AMQP is session-oriented, so it does, you know, allow you, like sort of like TCP/IP, right, with the retransmission logic and all that stuff and the sequencing logic, it has it built into it. But at the same time, you know, there are these, some of these devices which don't even support AMQP. They use these very esoteric protocols. And in order for it to support that, you need something called a field gateway, right? Which is a very simple device that you put at the customer location or at wherever these IoT devices are located. And then, so all the IoT devices may, for example, talk using some sort of a Wi-Fi protocol to this gateway, and then that gateway would then in turn talk to Azure IoT Hub, you know, kind of act like a proxy into it. So in many cases, that's what you have to do.
So I guess the advantage of that, Sajid, then, is just to make sure I understand, is that you can rely on your local network to talk to the edge, right? The hub, and
right.
Then the hub, really, then you only have to have a quote unquote good connection from the hub, and also you could probably, I would assume that the hub is optimized for, you know, retry logic and, you know, all those kind of things. And again, you only have to do that once rather than having to have that on all the different devices.
Exactly. A good example is a building, and if you control all the lights, if you have all smart lights everywhere, right, you may have hundreds of lights in a building, right, and then you have maybe hundreds of buildings. And so you know, all these lights talk to a central gateway on the building, and the building has in one connection to IoT Hub, and then you have hundreds of, you know, those buildings that connect into IoT Hub. So they're all kind of funnels in that way. So that's one way to do it. It's just because some of these devices are so small, they don't have a whole lot of smarts in them in terms of being able to do complicated protocols, you know, because AMQP can be considered a complicated protocol. And these devices have just a few K of memory. They're very, very simple. And they can put out a few datagrams on a Wi-Fi network at most, you know. And so these field gateways have to pick up that information and repackage it and send it off. And there is, you know, software and hardware field gateways that are available that do all this kind of stuff.
So it's like almost as much RAM as my computer from the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. So, so getting this information in is, of course, one thing. And then, as I said, you know, once we'll talk about the security in a bit, but once you get the information in, what do you do with it, right? I mean, you have to kind of pass it on to something that will be able to process it. And, you know, I think we may have talked about the event hubs in the past in one of the episodes. And the IoT Hub takes advantage of event hubs. Okay, so on the right hand side, on the side where it sends the data that it receives to the application logic, on that side it makes available an event hub, a compatible queue, and so you can point anything that works with event hubs to that queue. Okay, so obviously you could write just simple, you know, application in Java or .NET or Node and connect into it using the SDKs, but you can also use one of our existing Azure services. As you know, we have a number of Azure services that actually support event hubs, right? Like the HD Insight, the Stream Analytics, and things like that. So that's like an out-of-the-box solution, no programming required. You point to the IoT Hub, and it will suck down the data, and then you can do the normal things that you do, you know, today with those services, with Stream Analytics. It runs sort of look for certain patterns, figure out, oh, you know, this looks like this machine is about to die because we saw this patterns in a row, and then, you know, do some kind of alerting out of that.
So really, this is, you know, I guess the IoT Hub is, again, about layering in the stuff it takes to get the data into your standard places. I mean, that's kind of what you're getting at, Tiji, right? Is,
yes.
You know, Stream Analytics, you don't have to care, really, where this stuff is coming from or how it's getting there. And that's where
you're just pointing it to an event hub. Yeah, it just kind of, you know, it exposes this event hub protocol compatible queue, and so you're just pointing to anything that supports event hubs today can talk to that queue,
right,
and suck
right.
down the data and do whatever it has to do with it. And the kind of advantage over here is, again, when you talk about scale, right, we gave the example of all these hundreds of buildings and each has hundreds of lights and or maybe hundreds of sensors in the buildings. This eventually is a lot of data that's coming through, and you have to have infrastructure to be able to take that amount of data, right? So obviously using something like Event Hub is very good because you can queue it up, and then your applications can pick up the information in that queue for as long, you know, and process it in an expedient way. But at least the messages don't get lost. They get saved for one day. I think the typical time to live is one day, and after a day, I think they're discarded. I think if you have some of the highest queues, you can increase that. But that's typically how that kind of thing. And that's what they call a hot path, right, where you want to take this data and process it immediately. You may have something called a cold path where, you know, I just really want to save all this information into a blob storage and maybe run an HD Insight job later at night, you know? And so you can do that too. IoT Hub lets you say, okay, just take all these files, all this data, and put it into a file in blob storage. And, you know, send me a trigger event to indicate that, okay, this file is now available. And then you could, take run a batch job at night or something like that, or an HD Insight job that takes all that data and processes it and tries to kind of make sense of it, you know?
So one question, too, is, Ajit, or one thing that I've heard about that is unique about this, like to compare, if you like to compare like a IoT hub versus like just a standard event hub, is I think one of the key things is we can only do ingress on an event hub versus its bidirectional with IoT Hub, right? It goes device to cloud or cloud to device.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good one, yeah. Go ahead, Kale.
No, I just wanted to – there's a thing up there on the website. We can put it in the show notes, but basically compares the kind of a grid that would compare these two. And that one's one that stuck out for me when we were looking into this earlier about, you know, how – what's different about these two. They're both hubs, but what makes it unique, you know?
Yeah, I think that the thing that jumped out at me, I was just, you know, kind of curious, like, you know, we were talking about how the clients don't have to be really smart to do this. And it looks like, you know, looking through the documentation kind of as we were digging into this, not only does the client not have to be smart, but I don't have to be smart because the list of devices and OSs that these libraries are already built for and certified for, right, that we have an official SDK is, I mean, tremendously long.
It's amazing, yeah. And they have two SDKs. They have one SDK for the client for the IoT devices,
yeah.
And you know, of course, they have all sorts of them. You know, C++, because these little devices are written in all sorts of weird languages, right, or frameworks. So they've got C++ SDKs, Java SDKs, .NET, of course, Node, etc. And then on the other side, on the receiving side, we receive it. You could write applications in a whole bunch of frameworks that can take this data and process it. But as Kale rightly mentioned, sending data back to these devices is the most hardest thing you can do.
Yeah.
Okay. Primarily because these devices, for security reasons, have no web server built into them. Okay. They only make outbound connections. That's the one key kind of recommendation for these IoT devices. I can only make an outbound connection. Nobody can connect into me, right? That kind of gives them some kind of security boundary where people can kind of log into the device and hack it. And so if these devices, if nobody can connect into the device, then how do you send a message to the device, right? And this is why, you know, you have to have things like long polling, right, where the device will connect into the hub and say, you know, hey, is there a message for me? And it'll wait for 60 seconds and, okay, no message. Okay, go, let me try again. Is there another message for me? So you kind of, you know, rely on things like long polling to be able to suck down these messages. Of course, if they use AMQP, that's based on a TCP/IP connection. The TCP/IP connections can stick around forever, and so that's a permanent session. So that's always up. They even support WebSockets, I think, and things like that. So there's ways you can get around some of those protocol gateway, the proxy limitations, and things like firewall limitations. But you know, eventually you have to be able to send information to a specific device, right? You have a million IoT devices, and I want to tell one of them to turn on, right, or to turn their light switch on or whatever it is, the command that you want. And to be able to do that is very difficult because you not only have to have the infrastructure to identify the device, but then you got to send that message to that device in a way that is guaranteed to send it once and only once. The last thing you want to do is to send it two messages at the same time, right, like, you know, go fast and go faster still, right, or something like that, because that'll be disastrous, you know, in some cases. So IoT Hub does that. It will try for up to a whole day to send a message to a device, and you know, because the device, as Kale said, may be offline, maybe have bad connectivity, and it'll probably come up at some other point. Imagine if you were, in some remote drilling station somewhere where you have satellite feed or something like that, and you don't really connect all the time. So it has that facility to send the one and only one message. And after 24 hours, if it's not able to send a message, it sends an alert into another sort of dead letter queue to indicate to you that, hey, you know, we couldn't send this message. Maybe you want to do something. Maybe call somebody at the facility and find out what's going on, for example. So, you know, sending these messages to these devices is very, very difficult. And it all comes down to the security part, right? How do you provision all these devices? And so IoT Hub does that for you. It has facilities where you can create these device IDs in the system, and each device ID is mapped to a specific device. And that kind of, that's basically, there's no anonymous access in the system at all. You either have an authorized device or you're not getting into the system. Simple as that.
One thing, Sajid, I had a question about, you mentioned a bit ago. So if we have, it seems like there's, at least in my mind, like three different types of devices that from a real, like a category perspective. So we have one that's really smart, can talk IP and all that kind of stuff, and can do these advanced AMQP messages and things, and that's cool. That guy can talk directly to IoT Hub, everything's happy. And then we have one on the other extreme, which is like these low power you said about, and we have this thing called this IoT Field Gateway, which proxies this call maybe directly to the IoT Hub. And then there's another one that I heard about, this IoT Protocol Gateway. What does this, this seems to me like something that we would provision inside Azure, and then our device would be like something that would come into this thing, and it would translate it into something the IoT Hub expects, like AMQP.
Yeah, it, that's for the non-standard protocols. It can, so you can stand up another kind of gateway in front of IoT Hub, because IoT Hub only speaks AMQP and HTTPS, right? Those are the two protocols that it sits. So if you want to do something different, you can, you know, you could put the protocol gateway on your on the customer site, or you could have this field this protocol gateway, like you just said, over here in front of IoT Hub, and then do the translation in the cloud itself. It really depends on where, you know, again, you want to try and keep the number of connections minimum, right? You don't want, like, if you can keep it down to a few connections coming out of your facility, that's best. But if that's not possible, and you do need to, each one of your devices need to connect individually, then so be it. You're just going to need a, you're going to need a bigger bandwidth for that, obviously, right? So, the trade-off comes in that area.
I guess my question is that something that's like just like, I don't know because I haven't used it. Is that like a checkbox or something in this when I provision this that I say, yeah, I need a field protocol gateway, or is that something else I deploy and then I point it to my IoT Hub, or I don't know.
It's a good question. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what the mechanics of that is and how you provision it. But I think there's a few different options. It's not just one gateway, right? This, because as I said, there's this n number of different protocols that are supported by these IoT devices, and they have, I guess, custom gateways that you can put in there in front of the IoT Hub. I think we talked about the provisioning and about sending these messages. The last part I want to talk about is, you know, there's also a facility where you could tell an IoT device, like, for example, if you were collecting, I don't know, let's say it's a camera, right, a Wi-Fi camera that you have, and you want to tell it, hey, you know, every time you send somebody there, you know, start recording the video and upload it to our file server or our blob storage. And you can do that. IoT Hub can do that. It can tell the device to put it in a specific file storage, blob storage. So that's another kind of feature that is available in IoT Hub, direct to blob storage.
So you could do. So you could basically say, send my picture, like you were saying, to blob storage, but send my message about the picture, my metadata, you know, to
the telemetry system.
Yeah, to the telemetry direction, so that you can know that it's out there. Okay.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. Okay. So yeah. So that's kind of like the. That's how I try. I understood IoT Hub, and I encourage our listeners to. As I said, if you can get your hands on one of these Raspberry Pi devices, running the Windows IoT 10 core on it, you can also run just Raspbian on it and write it in Java, some of the other languages. We have SDKs for all of that, the client SDKs. And then on the receiving side of it, you could write your own code, just running in a VM somewhere or running as a web job. A lot of them do that just to kind of avoid having to stand up another VM. You'd use a web job on the other side to be able to receive these messages and process them, or you could just use Stream Analytics or if you're really very advanced in your usage of Azure.
Yeah, I think it'd be cool if some of our listeners have done. A solution would be great for us to, you know, reach out, and we're happy to have them on to kind of talk about the pieces and parts that they're using, right, as they go
through. Absolutely. Yep. So we'll put some links in the show notes to some of the stuff, and I think that's a wrap. Anything you want, Kale, you want to add to any of the stuff with customers and things like that?
I think this is great. I don't work hands-on directly with a lot of IoT stuff. I'm aware of it, and I talk with people who are doing stuff in this space at some points. I just did a couple weeks ago, and it's interesting. I think it's a really cool thing because it's got all these little pieces that are really intricate. When you start talking to people who deal with these type of embedded controllers and those kind of things, it's kind of like a whole other world to me. You know, like even the Raspberry Pis, they're so cool because they have like no memory and all, they're very small, but they do these really amazing things. I think it's really fascinating to see how these things all get put together.
And it wasn't difficult. I said, you know, I just wrote a little bit of program and put it up on the Raspberry Pi side. I wrote a small app and I wrote it on my Windows side, and I was able to get the two to talk to each other bidirectional, you know, just through IoT Hub. It didn't take a whole lot of, maybe it took half a day, I would say, for the whole thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Compare that to how long that would take you to do if you were doing this from scratch, or even
exactly.
even if you just had the SDKs for everything and you had to set up your servers and all that, you'd be talking days, easy.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
All right, so then that's a wrap for this topic, and thanks guys for all your input.
Yeah, no, it's good. I'm kind of with Kale. It's an area I see people use and don't have a ton of experience myself, but it's a neat little area. Or not little. It's a neat area.
Yeah, thanks for all the info, Sajid. This was awesome, man.
I think Microsoft has put a lot of work. I know they've been working on this stuff for a long time to try and get the package for IoT Hub just right, you know, with the right amount of, you know, you don't want to make it too complex. At the same time, you want to make sure that it's flexible enough, you know. And they, I think they really struggled with how, you know, where to position it. I think they've done a good job. All right. Well, thanks, guys, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. See you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.